if I had been a dad of sons, or
Yeah.
even a dad of daughters, or even a mother of daughters, I would not have been picked on, I don't think, the same way as being a mother of sons. There was something wrong with being a competitive mother, where if I'd been a dad, I'd have been a driven dad, and look at him, isn't that great?
Yeah.
Whereas I was made to feel like there was something wrong with the way that I was behaving, and I never felt that there was.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Talent Takes Practice, a podcast looking at what it takes to make the top of your chosen field and how we can use this experience to help youngsters maximise their own talents, whatever those talents may be. Now, in a previous episode, you'll remember, I hope if you've been listening, we spoke to Anton and Rio Ferdinand about the dynamic of two brothers, both making it in elite sport. In this podcast, I'm very excited because we are going to be looking at probably the most famous sporting mother in the UK, Judy Murray. We're going to join Judy in a minute, but first, Robbie, obviously you know Judy well. Were you on Strictly together, or did you go in consecutive series?
We'd done the Christmas special together, and I'm still can't get my head round how I got the same score as Judy. Technically, I was far better. I graced the dance floor better. And I've got no idea how on earth, it must have been Christmas and generosity that Judy got 31, the same as me. I was, you know, quite embarrassed by that, really, because I seen Judy's footwork and really poor.
So I think I was actually at that, the filming of that.
Yeah.
So I should have known that before asking that question. But by the way, Robbie, just before
Listen, that's tongue-in-cheek, obviously, but Judy's dedication and her drive and her determination. Listen, she was doing flicks and tricks and somersaults, and it was quite incredible. So, you know, seeing Judy in action, I know probably where Jamie and Andy have got their drive and determination from.
And just before we go in, because you have a son at the start of trying to build his own footballing career. So this question of parenting, nurturing, how to get young people to make the most of their own talents without becoming a pushy parent, without destroying that inner passion for a game. What's your take on it?
Well, this is the question I'm going to ask Judy, you know, when we speak to her, is that I've got two sons. One son is at Manchester United, as listeners to the podcast will know, and he's thriving. He was great at school. He got 6 9s and 4 8s, which is like A double stars and A stars. And my youngest son, you know, as he's flourishing, but he's not at the same level as his older brother. So, you know, I'd done a grassroots team to basically to help him and make him feel special in a way, although he's not as talented at school or in football as his brother. So, you know, I try and help him as much as I can. And maybe I gravitate more towards him and helping him more than I do his elder brother, because his elder brother just gets on with it. He's so talented, unless he's got a long road ahead of him. But, you know, it's interesting. I'll ask Judy that. So maybe I look at myself and think, should I put more time into my elder son, who's probably more talented? So it's a great dynamic, Matthews, which I'm looking forward to asking Judy.
Well, fascinating. Thanks, Robbie. And Judy, we're so appreciative of you joining us today. We had a few technical issues, but we've addressed them. That's part of the tenacity we've come to know enough. Just out of interest, before we get onto the meaty part of this podcast, what's your recollections of the Strictly Christmas special?
Oh, you know, I mean, I go into these things to have fun and to meet people. And, you know, I made some great friends from my time on Strictly, and again from doing the Christmas special a few years later. And of course, meeting up with Robbie again was just absolutely brilliant. And we were taking the mick out of each other, something awful, during all the rehearsals. And I think that, you know, I ended up thinking, I just want to do better than him, which is exactly what I thought when I did Strictly. I just wanted to do better than Tom Evans, who was the other Scot that was in it. We had this kind of friendly rivalry. But, you know, it's a real challenge, isn't it? Learning a new skill and performing something that you're rubbish at in front of a live audience and millions on the TV. And, you know, I'm not in the entertainment business, so it is a step out of your comfort zone. But really, you have to approach it with the fun. And for me, doing the Christmas one was great fun because of the people that were around us. There's a lot of dead time, and And you know, you end up talking a lot of trash with people, and Rob's very good at talking trash, and he was very much trying to talk me out of some of the more adventurous things that I was trying to do in my routine. And I have to say, he provided me with a lot of the fuel to try and get it as right as I could get it. And don't forget that I'm a granny and these things are not easy.
I mean, it's interesting when you mention about being outside your comfort zone, because I've seen Robbie in lots of different contexts, but when I looked at his face, because it was live, you were filming it as live, so millions of people watching, and Robbie looked nervous. But Judy, is it more nerve-wracking for you doing something like that, or being a mother watching your son play a Wimbledon final? And by the way, not just a Grand Slam final, because there's been a jinx on British male players winning that competition, I think, since Fred Perry. And it was like a national occasion. It wasn't just a sporting occasion. It was a national occasion. I know for my mother, watching me play ping pong at the Reading Closed 1982, that she would get so nervous she could hardly hold down her food. What it was like for you? Tell us the difference in the kind of subjective feeling of pressure when you're out there performing and when you're watching your son or your sons.
Well, look, I think that when you're a parent, it doesn't matter what your kids are doing. You just want things to go right for them. And in a lot of the things that they do, probably most of the things that they do, you know that you can't help them. You know, they are at a distance from you, they're actually in somebody else's hands, so whether that's a referee or an umpire or a team, or, you know, whatever it is. But you just want things to go right for them. It just so happens that my kids do things in front of millions of people on the world's biggest stages. And with Andy, he's out there on his own. With Jamie, he's got a partner with him. But it hasn't got easier over the years. I mean, I think when they started out, I found it, you know, it was fun, it was an adventure. We were learning that any disappointment or defeat was an opportunity to learn. You learn from what you couldn't do so well, and you took it onto the training court and or the gym or whatever, and you worked on it. Where I found it really hard was actually when they got right up to the top of the game, and suddenly it was a completely different mindset that was needed to stay there rather than the getting up there, which was relatively little stress, but, you know, and great fun, great learning experience. And I found it as a parent, I found that time much harder in terms of watching them. And I always describe it as a mixture of a heart attack and severe nausea all going on at the same time. And, you know, for me, it was the same kind of feeling just before you walked down those steps at Strictly at the Elstree Studios, when somebody says dancing the whatever it was supposed to be. It never looked like what it was supposed to be, as you know, Robbie. And that dread of actually doing something brand new to you, and you're terrified you're going to forget the routine. I was terrified I was going to trip because you were always wearing heels and I never wear heels. So I never really felt comfortable. But I kept telling myself, you know, that I've always used common sense and logic. But it was like, come on, it's 90 seconds. You've been practicing it all week. Come on, you know, trust yourself. And actually, I never really did trust myself. But I have to say that you're only out there for 90 seconds. The kind of torture only lasts for 90 seconds. And when you get through it, whether you did well somewhere in between or rubbish, there's a sense of achievement because you've survived something that was really difficult. And yeah, you gain in confidence because of that. And I loved being part of that whole thing. But I think it's the same kind of feeling, but it's the Strictly thing was all on me and it was very short. If I'm watching Andy or Jamie in a Grand Slam final, they can be out there for 4 or 5 hours and the torture never stops.
So, you know, at the beginning of this podcast, when Matthew asked me about my son's Judy, was it Andy or Jamie who showed the most potential? As a parent, as a mother, did you like concentrate on subconsciously more on the weaker one, if there was a weaker one?
No, it is difficult, Rob. It really is, because you want to be fair to both. And I think, you know, when they were growing up, the boys are 15 months apart, and Jamie always beat Andy at pretty much everything through those formative years as the older brother, a bit bigger, a bit stronger. And I always say that I think that Andy owes a lot to Jamie for his mega competitive streak. He always wanted to beat his big brother. But Jamie was always beating him, probably up to about 12, 13. And for me as a parent, it was always easier for me if Jamie did better than Andy, because that was kind of like the natural order of things. When it was harder was when Andy started to beat Jamie, yeah, and would kind of gloat over it, and that was a difficult thing to manage. And I think that their careers went in slightly different, well, probably very different directions from 14, 15. Jamie stayed at home, finished school, and then went off to try to be a tennis player. And Andy went off at 15 to Spain because he'd run out of options. There wasn't a competitive enough environment for him with the right surfaces or the weather or anything in Scotland. And he went off to Spain. So they didn't see a lot of each other for, you know, for a few years. But when Jamie finished school and he got his exams, he got his results, and he was going to go to American University. And then at the last minute, he changed his mind and he said, "Mum, I want to do what Andy's doing. I don't want to go to American University." And I was like, oh God, because the cost of it was enormous. It was way more than we could cope with. But you can't give one the chance and not the other. And so we had to find a way to help Jamie to do it. But at that point, Andy's career was much further on than Jamie's. Yeah. But you can't favour one. You can't give one the opportunity without the other. And so we tried with both.
It's fascinating that. And I'd love to come back to it. But just for the listeners who are not familiar with your journey, I mean, you were a very accomplished tennis player in your own right.
Amazing. It was amazing.
You were the Serena Williams of the Scottish table tennis fraternity, obviously. But you had this background as an accomplished player, of course. And a lot of people, Judy, when they think about tennis parents, they think perhaps of Richard Williams, who would take Serena and Venus down and he'd have a trolley full of balls and he would fire them at them. Or Andre Agassi's father, who would train them every day. And it was quite an oppressive atmosphere. But with you, can you give us a flavour of what it was like? Were Andy and Jamie dragging you to the courts? Were you dragging them? And if they, for example, showed interest and then one day they thought, you know what, I'm not in the mood, how did you decide how hard to push them or whether you should coax them? How do you get that incredibly difficult balance right?
Yeah, it's a good point that you make about tennis parents, because there are many tennis parents who have very bad reps. And I think when you talk about Agassi's dad and Venus and Serena's dad, they set out to make their kids champions in tennis. And Richard Williams, the family were from a very poor area. And he went and watched a WTA tennis event when his kids, maybe before they were born or when they were very, very small. And he decided that, my kids are going to be tennis players. And he kind of taught himself from books and found public courts close by and basically trained them himself. And he didn't have a tennis background. I mean, he did the most remarkable job, because they are absolute trailblazers in women's tennis, and they changed the face of the game. They made it all about the power, and particularly for, you know, players of colour, particularly women of colour. There are so many players of colour on the women's rankings from the United States because they had those role models. So that was a very different thing. I wanted my kids to enjoy sport. Tennis and badminton were my sports. I played badminton in the winter because we didn't have any covered courts, and our weather is pretty crap in Scotland. So you did tennis in the summer and you did badminton in the winter. And I played for Scotland at both of those sports. That doesn't mean I was great.
Wow.
I mean, the playing pool, or the competitive playing pool amongst women in tennis in Scotland, was very small. In badminton, it was probably a little bit bigger. But that was kind of what I did. But I enjoyed all sports at school. So when my kids were small, I wanted them to try everything in the same way that me and my brothers had tried everything. And you know what it's like, somewhere between 8 and 10, you start to pick the things that you enjoy the most. And for Jamie, it was golf and tennis. For Andy, it was football and tennis. And, you know, if I look at Andy, who obviously went on to be world number one in singles and won his Grand Slams and his Olympic golds and the Davis Cup, You know, he was playing as much football as tennis up to about 14 and a half. He played for a little club called Ochterarder Primrose, played for another one called Gaerdok in Falkirk. And actually, the football training did his fitness training for the tennis. He had a completely different set of friends that he went to football with. They were all in his class at school. And a completely different set of friends that he did tennis with. The tennis was, for the most part, individual, or you played a bit of doubles, but it's me against you sort of thing. Whereas the football was all about being part of a team and working together. And for me, it was like, it was absolutely perfect. And then it got to a stage where he had to make the choice. You know, he got the chance to go to some kind of centre of excellence or training thing with Glasgow Rangers, which was an 8-week block that he had to commit to. And at the same time, he was to go to Italy to play with a GB squad in a tennis thing. And I said, you got to choose, you choose. And he chose the tennis. And that was really how it kind of started going more down the tennis route. But he loved the individual combat of it. But he also, you know, he loved the team sport. And
was he good at football, Jude?
Yeah, he was. And it was interesting because the two positions that he liked to play in were goalkeeper and centre forward. It was like, I mean, who does that? But he liked the whole thing of being the goalkeeper and trying to save things, the challenge of saving it. And of course, he loved the whole thing of being the goal scorer and the kind of hero of his little junior team. But he went down the tennis route in the end, but it was his choice. And I think that's a really important thing with kids, is that we don't force them down what might be our choices, because I don't know anything about football, so of course it's easier for me if
not
he chooses tennis. Well, I know that. I should have said, I'll phone Robbie and ask him what he thinks. But yeah, I think it is important for them to make the choice. And, you know, Jamie had a 3 handicap of golf when he was 15, and he plays golf right-handed, you know, because we couldn't afford cut down left-handed clubs when they were small. So they had like literally one set of cut down clubs when they were little. But he went on without too much effort to be actually a very good golfer. But that kind of is always, I bring these points up often when I'm speaking, because I talk about the importance of investing in the physical skills with kids, the same physical skills that underpin all sports. And actually, you know, if Andy started playing golf, he played a bit when he was younger, but he never really had a handicap. And he started playing golf again when he was injured with his hip. And him and Jamie would go out and play early in the morning to get around in. And eventually he'd done enough to put his 3 cards in to get a handicap. And he phoned me up and he goes, "Mom, I got my first handicap at golf." And I went, "Oh, that's great. What did you get?" Expecting him to say 28 or something like that. And he goes, 6. And I went,
"Wow.
6. Wow. And he went, "Yeah, wow. I know, I should have had 5.
Wow. Judy, it's fascinating to hear you say that, because this idea that I think is in a lot of people's minds of early specialisation, you know, get Tiger Woods playing golf at 3 and then drill them relentlessly. If you look at most top sports people, they often had quite a range. They were late specialisers. And Andy, I think you said he specialised at something like 14 when he got the offer from the football club and had to make that choice, and you're encouraging them to do. I mean, there's actually quite a lot of evidence to back that up.
Yeah, I mean, I would always advocate that kids try as many sports as, because you don't know what you're going to like, you know, until you've tried it enough. And I think a lot of what you do as a parent is obviously formed by what you've experienced, you know, in your life. And I went to a school that was a girls' school, that, and my dad sent me there when I was in primary 5, so I'd be about 10, because I was sporty. You know, my mum and dad bit the bullet and sent me up there because, you know, the fee-paying schools do offer you much more opportunity in sport. And, you know, I'll always be very, very grateful to them for that. So I did hockey, netball, badminton, tennis, swimming, you know, for the school. And I loved the team things. And I think that so much of what I enjoyed about sport formed me to think, I want my kids to enjoy that about sport. And therefore, when I started to work as a volunteer at our local tennis club when my kids were in nappies, I was just doing a couple of hours a week and I wasn't a coach. So much of that was about creating an environment where there were school teams, club teams, loads of club nights, lots of fun competitions in there, that it was an environment where the kids wanted to come and hang out. And they didn't just do tennis. They could play squash, they could play table tennis, there was football in the park, there was a duck pond nearby, the golf club was literally side by side with the tennis club. It was a fantastic sporty environment for kids to thrive in. And there were, you know, numerous adults. I started a mum's army, you know, I got all the mums in to help me to run competitions, run the cafe, you know, extra pairs of hands, because nobody wants things to happen more for their kids than the parents do. And it's usually the mums that were around during the day. So, you know, my kids grew up in a place to hang out that had lots of different things going on, and lots of kids their own age and older and much, much older, to play with them or look after them. So, it was perfect.
You know, in football, Judy, I think the rewards now to be a professional footballer, some parents really push their kids. And, you know, if they've got, you know, I think it's 0.05% of 9-year-olds who actually get into academy go on to play in that first team. With tennis, you know, there's lots of kids who want to be the next Jamie or Andy Murray. What's it like with the parents if there's a bit of potential? Do they, you know, do they think that? Because in football, all the parents I speak to at grassroots think, well, they're gonna be a footballer, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I think this is where I'm such a big believer in the need for more, I don't quite know what you call it. It's not really parent, I suppose it's part parent education, parent advice, of understanding each of the different stages of the journey. You know, like... Yeah. What's the next year going to look like for you in terms of what are you going to need to learn about? What are you going to need to pay for? How's it going to affect your family life? You know, if somebody's got to be driving here, there and everywhere across the country, you know, massive believer in that, because if the parents get it wrong, everything goes to pot. And, you know, who can help them to get it right? The coaches. So you need to bring them in. They are part of that triangle, parent, athlete, player, parent, athlete, coach triangle. Everybody needs to be on the same page to help them to get to whatever the next stage is. And hardly anybody's going to get to the very top. And certainly in tennis, it's probably around maybe about 120 players in the world, men and similar in women, that can make a living out of it. And if you're 120 in the world, you're making a modest living. And that is because you're responsible for all your own costs. So your travel, your accommodation, your restrings, your physio, your entry fees, your coach fees, if you're able to afford a coach, your coach's expenses, and you're traveling all around the world. The circuit is 10 and a half to 11 months of the year. You know, the expenses are massive. So unless you are really achieving week on week at the highest level, you're not bringing in a lot of a lot of money. It's very, very different from if Andy had gone down the football route, for example, and he had been as good at football as he is at tennis. He would have been signed up by a major club, or probably several major clubs over his career, and he'd have had a salary, a bonus system, and everything, training, everything would have been covered. But, you know, the onus is very much on the parents to make everything happen if your child goes into an individual sport like tennis. And it's really only the very best that can survive and make a career out of it. So if these are other things that parents need to understand, that it's not as simple as saying, well, actually, look what Andy Murray did or Jamie Murray did, and actually you can do it as well because you happen to come from a small town and, you know, you've got a chance and you're very talented. The chances of it are small. So actually keeping up with your education and not putting all your eggs in one basket is absolutely crucial, in my opinion. But informing the parents and helping them to understand the journey that they're on and keeping it measured is really important. Otherwise, you just see the eyes on the prize, you know, the big money that exists at the top of the game, but you don't necessarily understand everything that goes into helping you to get there and helping you to stay there.
That's why I wasn't a tennis player, Judy, because only the best made it. I could be a rubbish footballer and still make it. That's why I chose football. Because I wasn't bad. You know, Judy, you mentioned there, but... And Matthew's wrote his book, hasn't he, about bounce 10,000 hours, because Matthew believes, I'm sure you've read the book, that if you can do 10,000 hours, you can be an expert in something. I don't think that is the case with football. I think you can be better. But do you think with a racket sport, you can become an expert with that philosophy? Or do you think you need that natural talent and then the hard work comes in?
I think you need a bit of both. I get asked that a lot about the nature nurture thing, and you know, it's, I think, you know, we all have characteristics, physical and mental, from our parents. We do. We are all products of our environment, you know, so certain things that we're born with. But, you know, the putting the volume in definitely needs to come in at a certain stage of every career. What that volume is, I think, probably depends on what the sport is, and maybe the personality of the child. But I would say that from when, if I was talking about Andy, from when he went to Spain was when he got the volume at 15, you know, because we couldn't afford the volume. And also, he didn't want the volume at a young age. He wanted to do his football. He wanted to do his tennis as well. He wanted to go swimming with his pals. Well, they didn't go swimming. They just did all those water flumes and things like that. But that's the social side, the educational side, and the sports side. You need a balance of that to give them a normal as possible an upbringing. I'm totally against the hot housing from a young age. I think it's just too much if you put all your eggs in one basket, because the chances of it going right in a, you know, in a straight line are so small. The chances of you getting to the top are so small. And if it's, that's your dream and that's what defines you, and suddenly you realize it doesn't work, it's absolutely devastating. It's like, you know, what I see in football, you know, kids get picked up by academies, they get signed up, they get labeled, they get, you know, and they get almost like this feeling that they're, right, I've been picked, therefore I'm going like this. And parents often think that as well. And it's never, well, it's very rarely that it happens like that. I'm very against labelling of kids at a young age. And we have it in tennis. We have a rating system, which can start from when kids are sort of 6 or 7. You play with a certain colour of ball and you have a rating, and you can move up a rating if you win a certain number of matches. And I'm thinking, these kids are primary 2 and primary 3. What? You just let them play. Don't label them. And if you label them, you know, the label can only be taken away. So why have it? Don't have something like that until they're old enough to understand it. I think it just causes a lot of problems. And I think there was a football club, I think it was Bayern Munich, you know, sometime earlier this year perhaps, that said they were getting rid of all their under-9 and under-10 teams, where they picked what they thought were the best kids from the surrounding area.
I think it was, yeah.
And it was the labelling again. And I read this and I thought, you are so right. And what they said was, we want them to experience other sports. We want kids to play for their local clubs and their local schools, because you need to stack, you know, at that age, you need more kids playing. And it's too much pressure if you're suddenly Bayern Munich under-9, you know, and then you don't make it into the under-10 team. What is the effect on that child? So I looked at that and I thought, oh, common sense at last.
Sorry, Matthew, just on that. So I've got an under-15 side, Judy, which my youngest son plays in, and you know, we've got all the scouts at our games looking for, you know, academy players. And one particular boy had got rejected at an earlier age, but he continued to play, and I tried to rehabilitate them from disappointment, and then he performed well, and then a club come in for him and said, can he come on trial? And an 8-week block. And I said to his father, I'm not sure he's quite ready. But, that was my advice to him, because I wasn't sure if he was at that level. And I thought it would end in disappointment. So because clubs are that desperate to get numbers in to facilitate games when they're only looking for 1 out of 15, I said, listen, if it was me, I wouldn't go. But listen, you do what you want. So the boy went into the club, and 2 weeks... they let him go, and now he's quit football altogether. He's quit football altogether. Didn't like the pressure. Didn't like the rejection, and it's broke him. And I took that to heart, and I found a responsibility that, you know, my rehabilitation with him wasn't enough. But it just goes to show that, you know, the disappointment for those youngsters. He's quit football altogether, which is so disappointing.
You know, on the labelling, Judy, you've heard of this gifted and talented programs that they have at school. It's not about sport. It's about educational attainment. And the danger of it is the label becomes more important than the game or more important than the activity. And those who are labelled, great evidence that those who are labelled gifted and talented, they think they're so gifted and talented, they don't really need to work hard, which is obviously important too. And those who are not gifted and talented think they're basically finished. So it undermines their motivation too. So I think you're right. It is common sense in a way that you get them to love the game, to love the activity, to grow organically rather than sort of imposing these labels upon them. However, Judy, that Mike, the producer, has told me on WhatsApp, I need to ask you one of the questions that we ask to all our guests. So the first of our three big questions is, you're a great coach. What was the weakest part of your coaching skills that you had to work the hardest to improve on?
Definitely it was the biomechanics, the technical understanding. Because when I was young, there were no tennis coaches. So I learned from my parents, and then when I got good enough to play with the older kids at the club, I learned from playing with older kids. And then when I got good enough to play with the adults, I learned, they taught me how to play the game, singles and mostly doubles. You know, so you just learn very naturally by other people that were around you. And I think looking back, what I also realised was they taught you not just about tactics and positioning. They actually taught you about intergenerational bonding and how to communicate with older people. And so often now what I see is kids get pocketed into age groups and they play with their age group and they learn age group sport and they learn age group communication. And so I think that, you know, when I started out at the club doing just a few hours a week when my mum could look after Andy and Jamie, I wasn't a coach. So I basically showed them how to play the game. So tactically, how do you make it difficult for the person on the other side of the court? How do you make them run? Forwards, backwards, short ball, lob, side to side, you know, changing the pace, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And, you know, I learned with a wooden racket. So I learned old school tennis. And what I realized was when some of the kids that I'd been working with for a few years got, they were getting quite good. And I thought, I don't understand double-handed backhands, topspin serves, these Western grips, you know, like Rafa uses, you know, where the hand is very far around the racket. I thought, I don't get any of that at all because of how I played the game. And actually getting to grips with the biomechanics and everything yeah. was probably the toughest thing for me. And actually all it did was when I went on courses was it bamboozled me with big names and difficult to understand. I just talked to me in layman's terms. And so I was getting all this angular momentum of the, you know, the shoulders and stuff like that. And I went, I said, I just say to the kids, turn your shoulders a little bit more. And the guy would say to me, yeah, that's fine. And then, getting to grips with it. And then I realized I don't need to get to grips with it. I just need to understand it. And I need to be able to express it in layman's terms because I'm talking to children. And I think I often hear coaches, you know, they go off on courses and they immediately come back with all these big names and trying this and trying that. And it comes back to the common sense again. What are you trying to do? You're trying to learn how to play the game. Of course, the better your technique is, the better you can play the game. But the playing the game is more important to, you know, that's where you're going to get competitors. That's where you're going to get winners. If kids get obsessed with how they hit the ball and biomechanics and techniques, they look for their solutions in a technical solution. And when they're in the game, when they're in a football match or a tennis match, or you don't have time to think about all of that. You have to think, where do I want to put the ball? Where do I have to go to next? So the whole playing the game thing for me is way more important than how to hit the ball.
So Matthew, if I relate that question to strictly, you could say footwork, movement.
Shut up.
Harsh.
Cruel but fair.
I think, you know, for what it's worth, I'd be interested in your view on this, Robbie. This idea that there is a coaching manual with a set of templates, technically and biomechanically, that young players need to use. I mean, in cricket, this was massive when I was growing up. I was crazy about cricket. I got a book by Geoffrey Boycott, How to Play Cricket the Right Way. And it told you exactly how you lift the bat, where your eye should be over the stumps, and a whole range of other things. And if you broke it, it was almost like you were being sinful. And you watch someone like Steve Smith now, who's learned to play by thinking of solutions rather than trying to fit his technique into a set of templates that were imposed by a coach. He's a beautiful player. He's also very adaptable to different types of bowling, different weather conditions. I mean, I totally get what you mean, Judy, in relation to tennis. Robbie, do you think there's something in that in football coaching? Game-related activity, not too much technical analysis?
Well, with my under-15s, Matthew, basically the goalkeeper, there's now this thing in football where goalkeepers have to play with their feet. And if they, you know, that's the modern-day goalkeeper. I say to my goalkeeper, listen, keep the ball at the net. Make saves. Simple as that. You know, if you can play out, great. My defenders, listen, try and keep clean sheets. Try and play out, but your job is to stop the ball going the net. Midfield players, you know, can you get the ball in the half term? Look forward. And in the final third, to the attackers, go and express yourself, make mistakes. I think the biggest thing for me, Judy, is with my team and my son is don't be afraid to make mistakes. We all make mistakes, as simple as that. If you don't make mistakes, how do you learn? And, you know, if they keep making mistakes, there's a problem. But, you know, of course, they've got to make mistakes and try stuff. Be, you know, express yourself. There's no point being safe. Go and enjoy yourself first and foremost and express yourself. But fundamentally, as a footballer, it's a team game. Goalkeeper makes saves. Defenders keep the ball at the back of the net. Midfielders try and be a little bit creative. And in the final third, forwards, express yourself. It's simple as that, really.
I've got to throw in the second question, which is, what is the one thing that you haven't got any talent in? But
oh, hang on. I can tell you that.
yeah, probably.
Judy, do you remember? Judy, do you remember? Do you remember when we were at Buckingham Palace? And oh, that was a great story. Do you want to tell it? The story of Buckingham Palace, Matthew, myself, and Judy. We went to see Camilla. So tell the story about the cake.
So there's a cake. There's this. We're absolutely starving because we've been in there for ages, and it's an afternoon tea dance, and they bring out the food, and there's this amazing chocolate cake, and I'm just waiting for it to come round to me, and I'm going, Robbie, pass that on, pass that on. And I went, oh, chocolate cake. I said, really good for the footwork. And he just looked at me deadpan and went, you better have the whole bloody cake then.
I think there was an expletive in there as well, wasn't there?
Judy, can I look, one thing that's striking me here, we talked to you a lot about bringing through kids. I'm conscious of the fact, Robbie, I don't know if this struck you too, that when Judy, when you came into tennis coaching, almost all of the coaches out there were men.
Yeah.
They were dads. And you would read this stuff in the national press, this Judy Murray. She's always out there. You know, you broke the kind of the stereotype of what a coach should look like. The other thing you did, which people thought was completely unacceptable, is you pumped your fist. I remember reading a piece in the Daily Mail saying, why can't she be more like Tim Henman's mum, who is demure and doesn't show her emotions? It's almost like you broke a whole range of golden rules that were knocking around at the turn of this century, the first decade of this century. And you just kept going. And I know from a conversation I had with you, it was, I think I did a public event with Jamie, and maybe it was Jamie and Andy, somewhere in Scotland. We had a chat beforehand, and it blew me away the difficulties you had faced as a mother just trying to help your kids and develop them as tennis players. Poison letters, insults. Just give us a flavour of what that was like for you.
Yeah, it was... I think that when I started coaching at the club as a volunteer, nobody was doing anything at the club for the kids. So therefore, I wasn't stepping on anybody's toes. And I built it slowly, and I brought in the Mum's Army, and we grew this amazing community club for all the kids in the village. And some of them started to get really pretty good. And I don't mean Andy and Jamie, I mean older ones than them. And my first success as a coach was Dunblane High School winning the boys' Scottish Schools Championships completely out of the blue. Nobody had ever thought that it wouldn't be anyone other than one of the posh schools that would win something like that. So that was a big thing for me. And then when I moved into the wider, what you might call a county, we called it a district. And I started to, you know, there was about 18 clubs in our district, and I started to create activity for the best ones from each of the clubs.
as in district squads, and we ended up with quite a strong district squad program, about 66 kids in it. And for me, that was about keeping them playing during the winter was the challenge. And I used to book school halls in the days when you were allowed to pick up the key from the janitor and open it up yourself and then hand the key back. You're not allowed to do anything like that anymore. But rubbish courts, you know, polished wood floors, zillions of lines up against the walls. But I used to do that on a Sunday, and I'd go three different schools, one after the other, for an hour and a half each time around the area, picking up the keys, et cetera, et cetera. And then I moved into being the national coach. And I got the national coach job, and it sounds quite a grand job. It wasn't back then. Nobody wanted that job because we didn't have indoor facilities. We had no good players, no international coaches, nothing like that. We had no infrastructure. So it was never going to attract somebody from another country to come in. And I had just passed the LTA's Performance Coach Award, which was their highest level of coaching award, and I was the first woman to pass it. And I didn't pass it because I was a good coach. I passed it because I was clever. I found all, it was very academic, I found very information based, whereas I would have rather had a lot more practical stuff. And because I could do all the projects and things like that, I passed it, but it didn't make me feel like I was a good coach. So I took all the information that I got from that course, and I tried to practically apply it with all the kids that I was working with. And when I got the national coach job, of course, I had the chance to apply it. But at no time was I ever stepping on somebody's toes. The challenges for me came when I stepped out of Scotland. You know, I was leading the way in Scotland because nobody else was doing anything. And when I went down south was really when that was more when I encountered the, maybe not so much, I suppose it maybe became a problem because you're one of very few female coaches, and you're not anybody of any great significance, and you're, I don't know, I found that difficult. What I would have loved to have had was somebody that I could learn from, you know, instead of having to find out everything for myself. I started to travel overseas to go to conferences and workshops. I got the chance to travel with the British 12 and under and 14 and under girls teams because I was a female coach. Because, you know, if it was me, if it was my daughter, I'd want a female coach traveling with my young kids, taking them to another country. But what it allowed me to do was learn as I went. I wasn't experienced in doing that, but I spoke to every other coach that was around. I filmed things, you know, on my clunky video camera. I've got notebooks full still up in my loft of everything that people said to me, because I needed to learn how to form players, and I didn't have anybody to learn from. But I think that even still now, you know, I mean, when I passed that Performance Coach Award course, there were 18 men on it and 2 women, and it was a year-long course, and it was a very uncomfortable place for me to be, and the other woman that was on it, who was very much younger than me, because you're scared to put your hand up and ask a question or answer a question, because I was the only part-time or voluntary coach on that course. Everybody else was at a big club down south, full-time coach. Many of them were ex-players, you know, Davis Cups and so forth. And there was a lot of ego around, not in all of them, but in a lot of them. And I found it a very uncomfortable place to be. And I think it's so much why now I do so much to try to encourage more women-only courses and workshops and organizations, because we need to be secure and confident. And if you're very much in the minority, you know, whether that is gender, race, social side, background, etc., it's just very, very tough. So we've got to spread the net wider, and we've got to be more inclusive. So yeah, and when you know, when Andy sort of burst on the scene in Wimbledon in 2005, and I was in the player box pumping my fist and come on, and all this sort of stuff. And I always say this to people, you know, I'm not doing it every single point. I'm only doing it when it's a really good point. And also, I think what people have to remember is that you've been there the whole way through, from their whatever they played in under 10s all the way through, when nobody else is watching. And when they look at you, they want some kind of positive reinforcement. Kids pick up on everything from you. And I learned that very early on, that if you're sitting there with your head in your hands or shaking your head or tutting or whatever, they pick up on it. And they don't need your anxiety. So everything I do is very, very positive. But with something like Wimbledon, where there are no ad breaks, and the cameras and the commentators need somewhere to go between the points at the end of sets, they will find you in the player boxes. And we were brand new in that Wimbledon 2005. And suddenly I found myself being picked out on the TV, in the papers, and the pictures that they always showed were ones of me baring my teeth or pumping my fist and looking like some kind of demented lunatic. And I was suddenly the pushy mother, the overcompetitive parent, you know, she's a nightmare, blah, blah, blah. And I was thinking, oh, wow, you know, I am absolutely, I'm not like that at all. But, you know, and I didn't react to any of it. I didn't do interviews. But nobody prepared us for what might happen if suddenly there was some success at Wimbledon. That's the thing. You just learned everything as you went along, which is, again, to go back to what I said before, the need to prepare parents for what might happen. And there was never any of that. So, I always say that if I had been a dad of sons or even a dad of daughters or even a mother of daughters, I would not have been picked on, I don't think, the same way as being a mother of sons. There was something wrong with being a competitive mother, where if I'd been a dad, I'd have been a driven dad and look at him, isn't that great? Whereas I was made to feel like there was something wrong with the way that I was behaving, and I never felt that there was.
You know, fascinating, Judy. Do you know, with Andy and Jamie, like, I'm experiencing that now with Charlie, who's at Manchester United. As we've said, 0.05% of kids who are that age will go into the first team, so it's going to be very difficult for him. But what were you like with Jamie and Andy? So I'm a dad first and foremost, like you're a mother to your two great sons. Is the first and foremost thing, when I say to Charlie, I let him come to me and ask him, Dad, how did I do? Because what I'm not going to do when he gets in the car, first and foremost, the only question I've asked him, did you enjoy it, son? And then I'll let him come to me, because I don't want him to feel like, you know, you're a great coach. You know, I played in the Premier League. Do that, do this. I want him to ask me, was it similar with you and with Jamie and Andy? First and foremost, a mum, and then would you tell them what to do, or would they ask you for encouragement?
Yeah, I think it was different at different stages. I think that often, you know, when I was at the club and when I was the national coach, we were nearly always travelling in packs of kids. You know, we would be in a minibus and there'd be loads of them. And so it was quite easy to talk about certain matches and ask questions and things without being the me and you thing. And I think that's one of the tough things about, you know, you get in the car with a parent after a match, whatever sport it is, and is it the third degree? And I think that I learned a lot from listening to some of the other kids talking about how their parents made them feel, that my dad didn't speak to me the whole way home because I lost. Or my dad took us to McDonald's because I won. And I'm thinking, yeah, you won, but you threw your racket all over the court. And I would have smacked your hand and said, right, you know, you're not playing for 3 days or something like that. It's you learn from watching and observing others to help you to get it right. But certainly I think as they got better, never to jump in straight away and offer your opinion. That whole thing that, like you're saying, Rob, of waiting until they bring it up and they give you an in. And then actually my style is much more asking questions. What if you played him tomorrow, what would you want to be able to do better? So that they're thinking about the tactics of the match, and then you go, okay, so when we go out and practice again, we can work on that, and then I bring it into the training. But you're trying to get it out of them what they have learned from the match, rather than you telling them, because tennis is a very cerebral sport, and once you're out there, especially if you're playing singles, you're on your own, and you have to be able to solve your own problems, you have to be able to think for yourself, you have to change from plan A to plan B. So it doesn't help, I don't think, if somebody is forcing your opinion and telling all the time. It needs to be about coaxing out of them and trying to ascertain what they have understood and maybe what they haven't. And if there are things that they haven't noticed, I mean, it's much easier now, I think, because you've got phones and you can actually film things and be able to show them things. And when we got to the stage when we had one of these clunky video cameras, I'd go, have a little look at that when you've got a moment, and tell me what you think, tell me what you see. and I would never force it on them, you know, and nearly always they would at some point go and have a look at it and they go, Mum, I saw this and I saw that. And then it comes from them. I think you have to be quite smart. You know, the better you understand the person who's in front of you, and when it's your own kids, you do understand them. The better you know them as people, the easier it is to find the right way to influence them, because you know what makes them tick. You know what they're going to rebel against. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're in it together. You have to help them to make the next step forward. It's just, I think it's about, like, not forcing it on them, just making them feel like they've come to it themselves. But if things are not going right, they know you're in their corner. You're not, I'm just there when you're winning, son. You know, it's like, for me, that whole thing, the whole way through their journey, through the juniors onto the men's tour, was all about learning. And every time there was a disappointment or a defeat or whatever, you always learn a bit more, I think, when you lose. And I never got caught up in the winning and losing. I always saw the long-term thing and the opportunity for what do we do next? What do we do? And if you take them with you, because they see it and they felt it, and they go, and then they feel confident because they know that you're in their corner and you're there to help them. They're not just there on their own.
And what do you think?
That's kind of my philosophy.
No, it's a great philosophy. Yeah. And when you're fast forwarding, and we've talked a lot about the development of Andy and Jamie, and honestly, it's just been so interesting to listen to your
fascinating
coaching philosophy.
Brilliant. Yeah.
You express it so brilliantly, and it all resonates powerfully with me. But Andy gets to the final of his first Grand Slam. And by the way, Andy is competing in by far the most competitive era in the history of men's tennis. You know, this three-way rivalry between Djokovic, Federer and Nadal, the three greatest players who have ever lived and may ever live. And Andy's trying to break into this closed shop, this monopoly of kind of genius. And he has a number of reverses in Grand Slam final. He gets to the final hurdle and can't quite get over it. What to you do you think was the most significant change for him to get him to win that first Grand Slam, which was, of course, that historic US Open?
I think it was probably having Ivan Lendl in his corner.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, he was obviously he'd been in the four finals and he hadn't won. But I think that every time, this is me talking from hindsight. At the time, I wouldn't have known it. But I think that every time you're in that situation, you learn something from it. And of course, he's playing in the strongest era of men's tennis of all time. And, you know, it's going to be incredibly difficult. Whoever you play, you know, you're going to have to play one of the three of them at some point during that event. But I think that what we came to realize was that none of us who were in his support team had the experience of knowing what that felt like to be preparing or playing in a final, to win a final or to lose a final, what that felt like emotionally. You know, so his tennis and physically, he was good enough, but mentally, who could really help him to get into the mindset that helps you to convert that? And of course, there's never any guarantees, but it just seemed to me that we need somebody in the team who's been there and done it and who can help him with on the day of the Grand Slam final. I mean, I got incredibly nervous on the day of the Grand Slam final, and my whole common sense would kept telling me, stay out the way because you're so nervous. He'll sense it. He'll say, why are you acting like that? Why are you saying that? Why are you doing that? You do act differently in those situations. You don't mean to. It, for some reason, it just kind of happens. And I could sense that. But and when we brought Ivan in, he had very similar history to Andy. He'd lost four Grand Slam finals before he won one. And he was his mindset on preparing for a Grand Slam was just, right, we're there a week in advance. We take each match as it comes, but actually we are practicing to play depending on when the draw came out. When the draw came out, you would find you might be in the bottom half of the draw and maybe you've got Djokovic in it, or you're in the top half of the draw and you've got Nadal in it. So actually we're preparing to play Nadal in the semis or Djokovic in the semis. So a lot of what you do tactically is actually with your mind on that, but you never take yourself away from the first match. You can never look too far ahead, but you have to be preparing for what's further down the line, because that's what you're aiming at. And he was very good at helping Andy to set his focus and to reset his focus if he was becoming distracted. So you can be distracted by all sorts of things, you know, a double fault, somebody shouting from the crowd, a bad call, a gamesmanship from somebody on the other side of it. And you can't afford to do that, because in a Grand Slam, because you're playing best of five sets and you need to win seven matches across a 13, 14 day period, you can't afford to waste energy. And in men's tennis, the level is so high across the board that if you have a lapse of concentration and you lose serve, the set's gone, and then you're having to play another set to make up for that. And eventually that all accumulates towards the end of the tournament in fatigue. So he was really good on that reset, resetting the focus, and don't waste energy. Just get back on it. And that would be something that Andy definitely needed help with. So I would say that Ivan helped him to learn how to manage everything through the preparation and through the course of the 2 weeks of a Grand Slam, because that is a long time to keep your concentration and your intensity get over the finish line.
Yeah, and what a match that was. Well, I think Andy said, I interviewed him, and I think he said that there was a period. Did Djokovic get back from maybe 2-1 to 2-2 in sets? I might have this completely wrong, but Andy said he took a bathroom break. There was a mirror in the bathroom by the court at Flushing Meadows, and he gave himself a pep talk in the mirror to get him ready for that final set. And that break, I mean, I'll never forget it. Am I right? Was it 2-1 and he came back to 2-2?
It was two sets to love up.
Two sets
to love up. And that's the thing with tennis, is you can never sit back and go, or two sets up, he's going to win now. You can't, not when Djokovic, Nadal, Federer are so good. They're such great competitors that you can never relax. And so, you know, I'm watching it, and I don't sit beside anybody. Nobody sits beside me. I just have my eyes trained on them the whole time. And it's torture. It's honestly torture. It's heart attack, nausea. It's the whole thing going on at the same time. And you're out there for hours. So two sets to love. And then suddenly it's two sets all. He goes to for the bathroom break. He comes back in, and he walked back from, you know, from the umpire chair, and he served down the end that our player box was at. And there was something about him that made me think, I think he's got this, because you can see, I suppose, the eyes, the body language, the whatever. And yeah, I read that afterwards, or, you know, that about looked in the mirror and I'm not letting this get away me again, and came out with this kind of renewed, I'm going to do this, and managed to win the fifth set. So,
The amount of times I looked in the mirror as a footballer was incredible.
You're always looking in the mirror.
With the hair gel.
Exactly.
I was trying my hair.
Judy, we got the classic Roberto. Brilliant. Judy, the third and final question that we asked to all our guests: what was the best piece of advice anyone has ever given you, and who said it?
I think it's a bit of a cheesy one, but it's the one that I always remember, and I always used to say it to my kids. I went to a junior tournament in just outside of Stuttgart. It was an under 14 tournament, and I was with a GB team, and the guy who ran the tournament, German guy, he was very small, and he stood up on this chair to address all the players and all the coaches right at the start of the tournament. And he said all his piece, and then right at the end he said, reach for the stars, but keep your feet on the ground. And I loved that. And I thought, you know, and it's kind of what I've always felt. Why shouldn't we reach for the stars? So long as you keep yourself grounded, common sense, logic, appreciate everybody that's around you, be polite, be humble. And, you know, like, I think it's I'm very proud of my kids for so many reasons, but I think the way that they have conduct themselves and the way that they have stayed true to their roots when they live in an environment where it's very easy to be affected the other way. I think they've done a really great job with that, and that's probably the one. I go, reach for the stars, you keep your feet on the ground.
Yeah, love it. My mother's
when I left Manchester United, my mum said to me, Jude, it's nice to be important, but it's more important to be nice. And I'll never forget that. You know, and I think it's true. You know, that is the truest thing my mum's ever said to me, that no matter how well you do, remember the people around you. You know, don't get big-headed, don't get carried away. You know, it's nice to be important, but it's far more important to be nice. And I think that is, I've taken that. I've got a tattoo on my arm with it on, believe it or not. So,
have you?
You know, yeah. So that's because it's so important. It's true. You know, you see so many people get carried away and change. And, you know, I watch Andy and, you know, I know he's been on League of Their Own a few times and programs like that. And is he a funny, funny guy? You know, because he has this, you know, guarded in the media. I know lots of football players who, you know, had media training, were so guarded because they were so successful and there was, you know, these answers. And when you see Andy, is he very, very funny guy?
Yeah, you would enjoy a night out with him. He's very funny. He's very dry. Not everybody gets his sense of humour. And Jamie is the same. The two of them together are a nightmare. I mean, like a nightmare. Jamie, when I did Strictly the first time, he put on Twitter a picture of himself behind the sofa.
I remember.
Do you think as listen, they were so close, as you've alluded to, speaking to Anton and Rio, you know, Rio in terms, they were both so successful, as have Andy and Jamie. Jamie winning the Grand Slam doubles tournaments. Anton and Rio, they were so close, and they both wanted each other to do so well. And I suspect it's the same with, you know, Jamie and Andy, where Jamie wouldn't say, I wish I would have won a Grand Slam singles. Do you understand what I mean? Well, I think they would probably both be so happy for each other.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, they're each other's biggest supporters and each other's biggest critics, but in a positive way. You know, I think Andy knows as much about Jamie's results, play, opponents, as he does of his own. And I think that's the thing. They can say things to each other that other people might not feel confident enough to say to them. And I think you need to have that. You need to have the family that can tell you how it is. And Jamie, of course, understands the top end of the game, as Andy does as well. And I think having each other around on the tour and in Davis Cups, Olympics, things like that, I mean, it's incredible. Like for me, the most time that I get most emotional and the most fun out of watching them, so long as they're winning, it's not much fun when they're not winning, but it's when they're playing together, you know, and that usually has been Davis Cup, a few times on the tour, but they are incredibly supportive of each other. It's very difficult for them to watch each other playing live because they can't go out into the crowds because they provide a distraction. But I don't know if you remember at the Australian Open a few years ago, Jamie won his first Grand Slam title and Andy was playing in the singles final the next day, and he watched it in the hotel and Jamie got into a position where Andy thought, I think he's going to win. And Andy ran from the hotel, ran to the court, came in and was there for the last two games, I think.
Fantastic.
And at the trophy ceremony, you know, Jamie went, Andy, what are you doing here? You've got a singles final tomorrow. Why are you here? And Andy was messaging me and he was going, I couldn't miss that. I could not miss him winning his first Grand Slam title. But yeah, they're incredibly close, and they're incredibly supportive, and they can be incredibly critical of each other in a good way.
Yeah.
So what would you say to parents, Jude, and, you know, kids who are starting out in all kinds of sports, you know, as a parent who's been there, who's done it, who's been a coach, who's had two wonderful sons, successful sons, what would you say to parents whose kids they might think have half a chance? What would you say to those parents, the pushy parents, the parents who just sit back and listen? What would you say to them?
I think that I would say, try to learn as much as you can about what the sport is going to demand of them at whatever stage they are at and what it's going to demand of you as the parent. Find somebody or a number of people to talk to who've been through it. I mean, everybody's individual and no two journeys are the same. So one size never fits all. But I think the more you can speak to people who've been through it, who can help advise you of some of the pitfalls and some of the things you might have to know about should they be successful, then you've got more chance. And it's not to say that anybody's trying to put you off, you know, by saying, well, actually we did this and it didn't work out. We are all different. Everybody's on their own path. But I think as a parent, you can't underestimate how much you can help your child if yep. you understand. The more you understand, the better. But the most important thing as a parent is to be supportive through everything, through the good or the bad. And for me, it was always about, you know, if you try your hardest and you come up short, too bad. But
I've got to tell you this as well, Jude. I'm not letting Matthew get away with this. A racket sport, ping pong, table tennis. Matthew, how old's Teddy Matthew?
He's six.
Judy, Matthew was paying Teddy 20 pence a shot if he'd done it well. What do you think about that, Jude?
Yeah, that was, Judy, I admit, this was terrible parenting. I know, complete error. I think I mentioned it in the podcast. Bobby and I used to do with Fred, and they were looking at me. You're clueless, but I did stop doing that. In fact, funnily enough, Judy, one of the things he said earlier is you need to know your children well. And sometimes, particularly with Ted, the six-year-old, I think, I don't know him at all. He's a complete mystery to me. But this has been fantastic. Look, Rob, I've loved it too. Great to see you.
It's been amazing, Judy, honestly. Yeah, Judy,
thank you so much for joining us. And thank you, Robbie. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Please remember to rate and review our podcast from whichever platform you get it. Spread the word if you can. Robbie and I will be back with another stellar guest, probably not as good as Judy, but we look forward to seeing you then. From now, from all of us, goodbye.